Dear friends, when we practice coming home to ourselves, we are not separating ourselves out from the world. We are bringing ourselves home and holding space to connect with all that we truly are. We're not coming home to ourselves like that sense of small self, we would call it in the practice, where I have a name and age and identity and career and experiences and sort of this entity that's created by us and by society and by everybody around us, like we're working together to try to establish a sense of me. It's not that we're coming home to. We're coming home to the experience of life in the moment. Our consciousness manifesting right here, right now, in its totally fresh, new, unbelievably it can be anything. We are everything. We're coming home to hold a space where we can be in that present moment consciousness, centered, radiant in our center, but centered. Usually we're going through the day and we're all over the place. We are dispersed. There's people we're paying attention to, relationships with them, there's work that we're doing, there's homes to keep, there's to-do lists to keep an eye on, there's lots of stuff to scroll with. We covered this, right? I'd like you to imagine that your mind, your awareness has a body. It's a spiritual entity in a way, it's a spiritual dimension of us, but it has a shape. So let it float out and take in the whole room right now, right? You can open your eyes, and my voice is like coming from here and over there. There's lots of space here, vibration you can touch into. You let your awareness kind of float out to this whole room filled with lovely people and a history of probably thousands of campers jumping around and making a lot of noise in the space. You know, you have a This space, you could be out here. And then we're gonna listen to and wake up the sound of the bell. It's coming. Oh, we're out here, but the bell means something. What does it mean? Bring it home. Let's listen to the sound of the bell. The body of our mind, our awareness, drawn in to this place, to these sensations, I'm still here with all of you, you're still here with all of you. We're still in this room. And yet, right, we come home to this center point of awareness. I find it really helpful to pay attention to the shape of my mind, the shape of my awareness. And it stabilizes me a lot. You know, it's something we do, right? This is what we do. So, for example, we didn't have the practice of hugging meditation, but it's an awesome example of this. And if you're a therapist, maybe you've learned this, and if you haven't, you must. But we have to practice it when we're really wanting to listen or be present for another person, right? In hugging meditation, Taiya introduced it as having sort of three parts, and he would use three breaths. It's kind of fast, honestly. It seems like a really long hug, but it's kind of fast for all that can happen in that. But the first event is to do what we just did, to come home fully into ourselves. So even though we're holding another person in our arms, we make ourselves fully present within ourselves, right? The body of our mind, the shape of our awareness comes in here. One breath, settled. Here I am. Now I'm just going to open enough to hold the other in my arms, but in my awareness. More than in my arms, because I'm already holding them in my arms. Now in my awareness. Right? So now I'm including the other in the embrace. Like the coming home to ourselves embrace is now coming home to you. One breath there, settling in. And the third part is to have the awareness of how wonderful this experience is. To be able to share a moment of life with another person. And we know that things are impermanent and things change, right? So treasure the experience we're having. That's the practice of hugging meditation. I think it's a wonderful example of this experience of getting to know our inner life enough that we know the shape of our mind. You know, and if you're ever feeling kind of worn down or stressed out or anxious about what's going on in a room or with people around you, this is a really helpful thing to check in with. Where is the shape of my mind right now? Have I just opened? It's kind of like the sentinels at the doors of eyes and ears and nose and tongue. Are they just letting everything in? Am I just porous? And whatever happens in the room happens to me, right? Or will I be, you know, draw it in and now I'm still here, I'm still in the room, I'm participating, but I'm not swept away by, because I've brought myself in. Really helpful exercise to learn. I first started experimenting that long before I encountered Thay's teachings. I was taking a permaculture course. I became got my permaculture design certificate when I was 19 in college. And I did it. It was weird, you know, you have to do a project in this course. And like an independent project to express your mastery of the basics of things, your competence, not mastery, but your competence in the basics, your understanding what the principles were. And I don't know why, but I chose this one about my senses back then. And I was in the Southwest, the drylands permaculture, it's in Arizona. And I practiced going to the edge of an overlook in this landscape where it dropped off. Went wide out. It's kind of looking a little northeast, so the sun would arose over there. Right? And I would walk up onto those rocks and I would sit there, and then I would practice these exercises with my eyes around perception. And I would look down at my feet and really come in to right where I was standing on that rock. And then I would take a breath and I would look at the horizon and watch what happened. What would happen when I started to go out to that space. And then I would spend a few breaths with that, and okay, let me bring it back in. And then I would journal about what I was starting to understand and learn. It was an awesome project. It turned out to be like my first little thesis on meditation. And I did that. I also did sketching. I stood still, or I sat down with a piece of a paper that was going to be my expression of the landscape in front of me, and I had some colored pencils that I would lay out, and I had to lay space between them because I wasn't actually going to look at them. Very, you know, like spend a lot of time, like it's like I had everything all laid out, and then I would just look at the landscape, and I'd look at a particular bush somewhere out there, and I'd pick up, that's the bush in the middle of my view here. Okay. Then I would only look up at that bush, and down at the paper, and up at the bush, and down at the paper, but I would draw the whole rest of the landscape without looking at it in terms of the focus point of my vision, but instead explore a peripheral sense of vision. The first ones looked really funny. They looked really strange because I was having a hard time. And also there were some times where I just, like, my eyes would just go and be like, oh, darn it. Okay, come back. Let's try again. But what I was exploring was this experience, right? Of this centering my awareness right here, right now. And then how much, when I'm here, I can still be present and connected and a part of everything that's going on around me. If in our spiritual awakening we just let go and we are open and open and open, we will be lost and overwhelmed. We need to know our center point of consciousness. We need to have that solid ground. Yeah. Okay, change of gears here. In Buddhist practice, we will often say something like, all suffering comes from the mind. It's an interesting statement. I don't know that it's really that clear or that actually like that. I wouldn't take it at face value if I were you. But we can be certain that misunderstandings within us or between people, misperceptions that we have or others have, definitely bring about suffering. Right? We all know this in so many ways. So misunderstandings, misperceptions, which often have a lot to do with what's going on in the mind, so thus that generalized statement, but misunderstandings, misperceptions bring about suffering, are the cause of so much suffering. We might even be able to say most or all suffering, maybe. It depends, I think, on how you define suffering. I like to distinguish between suffering and pain. You can poke me in the arm with a pin or a needle and it will hurt. There's pain there. But whether or not that's a problem depends on how I react to it, right? It might be because I actually want to give blood, right? So I'm not suffering because of that. So there's a difference there, right? I want to talk about suffering because hardship and pain are a part of the up and down of life. I don't think there's a way out of that, and I don't think that's created in the mind. I think maybe we suffer because we get worked up about it, and that's what we can talk about. So if you take this statement, misperceptions, misunderstandings lead to suffering, and you work it inside out, flip it over, it becomes, if I cultivate understanding, if I correct my misperceptions, there's the alleviation of suffering. It should be that simple, right? If it goes one way, it should be able to go the other. I like that about the Buddha's teaching. So, here's a song that some of you know and can join me in about misperception. This is based on commentaries on the Buddha's teaching from long ago that said something like, wherever there is perception, there is deception. And when I heard that, I went, that's a lyric. Okay. I need both my hands, so I'm gonna just do it loud. You can participate with this kind of thing. And make sure you got a little curve in there. It's coming from the belly. It's not about making a lot of thumping noise. It's about feeling and just grazing off your thigh, you know? Yeah. And then halftime, there's a snap. Try that. You also got to have the curve right here. It's a soft snap. It's halftime. And one of these goes for the verse and one goes for the chorus. And we're going to start with the snap. Because that's, well, which one is that? That's the chorus. Yeah. We've got a double time going here. Can we slow it down a little? This is like, you know, I don't want to say what this is like. This is casual, lounging around, hanging out. Maybe 95 years ago. Where there is perception, there is deception. Oh, my darling, don't you see? Don't you hear? Where there is perception, there is deception. Oh, my darling, let's be clear. Come on with this. Yeah, take the sunrise, for example. It looks so beautiful. Well, it might not be so simple when you discover that it happened 8 minutes ago. Where there is perception, there is deception. Oh, my darling, don't you see? Don't you hear?
Where there is perception, there is deception. Oh, my darling, let's be clear. You've got your loved one, now don't you love that one? Makes your heart burn like a flame. Oh, well, now slow down, don't have too much fun, 'cause what you see and the reality might not be the same. Where there is perception, there is deception. Oh, my darling, don't you see, don't you hear? Where there is perception, there is deception. Oh, my darling, let's be clear. You got your anger, hatred, and jealousy for the one who done you wrong. Oh, well, when you see how their pain it came to be, well, you might start singing to a different song. Where there is perception, there is deception. Oh, my darling, don't you see, don't you hear? Where there is perception, there is deception. Oh, my darling, let's be clear.
Every time I do that, I think I'm hearing more double meanings in some of the words. Don't you see, don't you hear? What does that mean? Thank you. So I shared a lot through this diagram before, this visualization of how the present moment life experience is coming into our being, is becoming a part of us, how we are a part of it through the senses, how the mind receives that, right? Receives all that input, maybe is doing some interpreting, evaluating and judging there, right? But it receives all that, and how at the same time the mind, goes through the mind and is stored as memory. And those memories are constantly also coming back up, all that habit energy, all that conditioning, all the transmission from ancestors arising up and influencing our inner landscape. Just like nutrients in the soil drawn up into the trunk of the tree, and also like the light and the elements coming in through branches and leaves, and there's this life of a tree happening there. And depending on how we're practicing in this place of power that we have in our inner life, right, our tree is vibrant and well, or it's a little bit withered, right? When you look at most trees, though, you generally don't see all vibrant or all withered. Just keep that in mind. Very rarely are we having like just one side of the story happening. In fact, some of the most beautiful trees are the ones that are in sort of full blossom of like life and decay at the same time. In this space, trunk of the tree, this place where we have our inner life, our heart and mind, our sometimes trying to make sense of what's happening, sometimes embracing and holding what's happening, sometimes being overwhelmed by what's coming from the senses and the world, or from beneath in store consciousness. In this place, there's two basic energies that I work with. And one I often call grasping. And this is actually the nature of the thinking mind, So thus the fun in that song, right? You're just acknowledging this is the way it is. My mind likes to grab onto things and tell stories about it, right? That's this holding. If you take a look at what's going on, the mind is like, it's taking photographs all the time. It's making static, finished images or concepts, unchanging, out of something which is flowing and alive. Just like a photo. It's just an instant. And if it was like, you know, as you get some people in front of you, okay, you ready? 1, 2, 3, and you take the picture on 2. Right? And then the funny expression that's on people's faces. And then we decide that that's what they look like. But that's not true. That's just a little snapshot. And the mind is doing that all the time. It's the nature of the mind to take a hold of like that. So that's not a bad thing. It really helps us navigate a lot. Like the fact that we can agree on the colors of traffic lights, you know, allows us to navigate at high speeds through crowded intersections. That's pretty cool. And that's a lot of grasping in the mind to make that possible for us to move and be safe at the same time. Yeah. So it's very functional to a certain degree. But where it's not functional is where that grasping energy is grasping onto a misperception, a misunderstanding. And then we get caught in the suffering that ensues from that. We experience the suffering that comes from that by trying to relate to another person or to ourselves or to the world from the place of our misunderstandings. It won't accord with reality. That's what that means. We're not understanding it correctly. We're not seeing it clearly. But we're behaving as if we are. And we're going to be very disappointed. Right? And there are many aspects of our life where we have this grasping energy that brings about the suffering. You could also call it, you know, tension or, I mean, anything you want. There's this grasping energy. It's like a kind of fear closing down, and it's even mirrored in the biology of our organism, right? The way we shut down and cut off in order to protect ourselves from potential threats and dangers, like that tension, that holding. So it disconnects us. It disconnects us from who we truly are and who others truly are, and from what reality in the moment really is. And we get stuck in that space of the mind inside, spinning around, unable to connect with present moment experience, unable to understand or be really allow alaya, the memory, to be what it is. It's unacceptable for us, right? We're caught in there. So in the mind and then mirroring out, we feel so bad, right? The heart and mind, the felt and thought experience, are really two aspects of the same experience. And so the feelings they're full of suffering, and the body takes that on and remembers it. And alaya, consciousness, takes it on and remembers it, right? And so it comes up again. That's the tension, the grasping, the holding, if left unpracticed with. If we don't practice with it, that's what happens. Our practice is sort of the opposite gesture. It's to create the experience of opening, of relaxing, of releasing, of liberating, right? And allow that, this beautiful lens that the mind is, this consciousness that we have, that we return to when we come home to ourselves, that center point, allow it to be clear, clean, so that it can see things as they are, right? But to do that, we have to let go, we have to release, we have to free, liberate. So these are two gestures that are really important for me in my practice. And just to notice, is it going that way? Right? Or can I let it go? Can I open? And in terms of developing a strong meditation practice, for me, the most important element has been relaxation, which is kind of weird, because you think of like getting concentrated into a meditative state as being a really strong-willed kind of determination. For me, the strength is in this, the courage to let go and to shed the layers of distractions, of worries, of anxieties, of expectations, to release those things so I relax into concentration, let fall away the things that don't serve that moment. Yeah. Mm. The will is soft, the will is gentle. It's there. Right? I want to be there, but I'm not forcing myself to be there. I'm experiencing the parts of me that are not serving my practice, my awakening, our practice, our awakening, and breathing them, letting them go. The teachings that we have received from our spiritual ancestors are really quite wonderful. And there's the particular lens, way of holding our inner life, our mind, the kind of thoughts we can nourish here, which really, oh, it's been so wonderful. Just opens the doors to the heavens. Cool. He didn't know that we planned that. Good timing. It's a kind of medicine for all this tension in our heart, all this pain in our heart. It's the understanding of interbeing, of the not separate self, the not separate self entity. Yeah. Mm. Another way of saying this in Buddhism, just so you know, in case you come across this, it's the word emptiness, right? Which can be a little confusing if you just take it in your head as a concept, as an intellectual exploration. You'll probably pretty quickly find yourself thinking about nihilism. And that's not what the Buddha intended. In fact, he had a few sutras where he very specifically said that. That's not what emptiness means. And Thich Nhat Hanh was really smart in that he very quickly turned us from the word emptiness in terms of thinking of nothing to empty of what? Empty of a separate self entity. So, you know, I am here, but I am not a separate entity from you, or from the food that I eat, or from my ancestors, or my children, right? There isn't a line you can draw. So this emptiness refers to the same thing as interbeing. It's another way of looking at it. So we use our eyes of interbeing. We take time in our daily life to rethink things from the way we were taught and the way that our habits just run, but to rethink them over and over again using the eyes of interbeing. It's like when you look at the flower. You could say, oh, that's a pretty pink flower, and look at the dark green of those leaves, and that's wonderful, right? But take a moment to really sit with that color. Breathe what it's like to be that rose, that hue, soft hue of red, that deep green. We hold the flower as an object of meditation. It's the fourth establishment of mindfulness, right? We're looking at the the form and the existence of the flower. So from here, I extend my awareness to include the flower. Don't just race out to the flower, stay here. And in that way, as you say, pink blossom isn't there, pink blossom's in here. So you're beginning to connect with the flower and know that the flower is made of different colors. There's a little bit of interbeing there. What is it made of? Where does it come from? Good questions to ask. When I ask that question of a flower, the first thing that pops in my mind is actually not the color. It's sun. And I think that's common for many of us. If you were a botanist, maybe you have many other things that are going to come into your mind about the flower, and that's awesome. You can use every one of them as a Dharma door into interbeing. But when I look at the flower and I see flower and I say, where do you come from? What are you made of? The answer I hear is sunshine. So take a breath. You've established a relationship already with the flower, centered, including the flower. What is it like to be a flower receiving the sunlight? And that's that moment of breathing, right? The flower made of the sun. The flower made of the minerals in the soil of the earth. Reach down. What is it like to draw the minerals up out of the earth and nourish you? Build the cells of your body. What is it like to receive the care of a gardener, providing the right warmth, light, liquid, water, water that comes from cloud? All these kinds of thoughts we can breathe with and open ourselves inwardly to the experience that a flower has. Its flowerness is actually sunshine. Its flowerness is earth. Its flowerness is water. Its flowerness is gardener. Right? It's not just flower as an idea. It's a transformation of all these elements, a continuation of all these elements of the cosmos coming together in this beautiful form. And as we breathe with that and feel what these things mean, we experience our own interbeing nature also, because we are also made of sunshine, although we don't take it in the same way as the flower. We are also made of the earth, so we know what it's like to construct the cells of our body from the elements of the earth. Yeah. And we are made of the care and the kindness of others. And also they're snipping off of dead leaves. All that's there too. And so we're touching, as we touch the interbeing nature of the flower, our own interbeing nature. If we were to consider ourselves as the object of the meditation, as we do in the practice of touching the earth that was offered two nights ago, we see how mothers, fathers, grandmothers, and grandfathers across generations, right, have continued and transformed into the being we know of as ourselves. Our interbeing nature with our ancestors. You can think that, great, but if you allow yourself to the time and the right conditions to meditate with this, to really let it become a part of who you are, to feel the experience of being a continuation of all these generations of ancestors, you open to a whole other level of who you are. And now when you practice bringing your mind home from the dispersion of the day to this center point of awareness, and I go, I'm going to breathe and come home to myself, What am I coming home to? Right? Flowerness. Ancestors. Right? So now this space of my mind and my heart is filled. Right? Filled with the vitality, the life, and the experience, and the wisdom. Right? All brought together by this practice. The trunk of my tree feels good now. I spent yesterday afternoon during Dharma sharing with Greg and Corey's boys and Amy too. And we had a really fun discussion about lots of things. So one of them is really into Dungeons and Dragons. I grew up with Dungeons and Dragons, so I could go with this. And in Dungeons and Dragons, there are there's a lot of magic in the world of D&D, and there's things like shape shifting and polymorphing, where you like can cast a spell and turn someone into an animal or something like that, right? And it was really fun to have this shape shifting kind of conversation. And as a children's consciousness is so imaginative and so fast. It's really fun. You can just all over the place and discover all sorts of amazing things that could be there. But for me, it was really fun because I'm like, I'm just playing with the ideas of interbeing here. And this is kind of what we're doing. We're becoming aware of our transformation bodies. This is actually a word in our, you know, the Buddhist practice, you know, your transformation body. It's like not the physical body, but it's like, the flower is the transformation body of the sunshine. We are the transformation body of our ancestors. And I'm like, wow, we're like polymorphing all the time. That's an English version of a Sanskrit word, lakshana, which can be translated as sign or mark, the outer appearance of things. We've already talked a lot about this, right? We're in a realm of outer appearances, and we're relating to the appearances that are all around us, the manifestations that are everywhere. It doesn't mean illusory, it just means appearance. Right. You might misperceive what's there, and then it's kind of illusory, but okay, I hesitate to use this word. But I think it goes in the direction, okay? So now I'm on the record as saying I hesitate to use that word. Because this has a sense of finality in it. Like a definition in it, like that's the thing. Right, essence, right? This word is svabhava, which is the Sanskrit word used to talk about nature. Like the nature of something, the meaning inside, the substance beneath the surface, right? So we've got these two concepts happening in our practice. These correlate with this beautiful image of Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching. The wave and the water. The wave that looks out from its vantage point at all the other waves. Try it. See all the other waves? The wave that looks out at all the other waves, you know, sees them different heights, different sizes, some smooth on top, some crusty, and looks out, some are taller, some are smaller, some are like jagged almost, and some are round and rolling. The water in the lake today was pretty mellow, pretty still, really beautiful to see. So there's all sorts of variations on the surface of the water. We look out, we can see all the other waves. We might get jealous of one wave because we think, oh, they're doing really well. They've got a lot of water in them. Yeah, you know, maybe we see some come and some go. But if we live only on the surface, that's what we see. We see up and down, good, bad. I like it, I don't like it. We see all kinds of things like that, like the beginning of that wave, and there's the end of that wave. Right? And if a wave is kind of moving along and looking out, and it's only staying in its waveness on the surface, lakshana, its own appearance, and the appearance of others, and there it sees the shore, and it feels the forces of the moon pulling the tides, turning, the wind, and all this stuff drawing it towards the shore. And ahead of it, it sees other waves hitting the shore and being smashed to billions of little drops of water. It's going to be very frightened because it's going to think, I'm here now, I'm going to be there, and I'm going to be gone. It will be the end of me. But if when the wave is being drawn towards the shore, she knows that she's water. She's got nothing to worry about. She's already in all the other waves. She's already in the depths of the sea. Right? When I move through my life and I'm just me, Michael, and I've got my struggles and my things, and I only stay up there on the surface of my life, and all my projects and attainments and all this grasping of trying to make something of myself and my life and protect what's mine and make it better. And there's a lot of suffering there and a lot of fear around having and losing, having resources and losing them, having loved ones and losing them. Because all I see is the surface. But when I can go deep and touch my truer nature through the eyes of interbeing, knowing these ancestral streams we come from, knowing the earth that we're all a part of, and I look deeply and I practice that, I don't have anything to fear. My happiness is not depending on attaining something measurable by society or some sense of some scale of worth and value. My happiness depends now on something else. In fact, it just lives within me as the expression of all of life. Please touch your ultimate dimension. That's what the water is. The water is the ultimate dimension. The wave is a relative dimension. where there's up and down and right and wrong. And Tai would always do this. It was so fun. He would write these things on the board and then he would go, "In your practice of interbeing, we do a Zorro." Your practice of interbeing is what allows you to touch, to bring the two dimensions of our life, your life, our life, really, together.
That's Mariah's case.
So again, this is not a kind of understanding that we cultivate simply by, you know, creating a worldview and a whole theory around how things work. We practice this in the situations that matter in our lives. A month ago, we had a ceremony in Morning Sun, a day-long ceremony organized by the community to remember loved ones who have passed away in the last year. Members of the community, but also friends in the region, in the area. Something like 40 people came. It was a pretty big group, and a lot of us were holding and celebrating family members and friends and others who had passed away. This is one of the ways that we can apply this teaching to help bring us to a place of more ease with these big changes that happen when our loved ones die. When you realize that you are the continuation, using the eyes of interbeing, your ultimate dimension, you are the continuation of all of your ancestors, it's very hard to say where you began. Can you say that? Where you began? Right? We can have all kinds of debates around like when life starts with, conception or whatever. But when you look deeply, like all that stuff is irrelevant. You can't find a moment that is your beginning, your beginning. You've only ever been a confluence of a multitude of miraculous conditions, right? And long before you were revealed in your mother's womb or after birth, taking your first breath, long before that, you were being shaped and formed by the lives and experiences of ancestors. Right? So we can't say that we have a beginning. If we don't have a beginning, how can we have an end? We also can look at the end, what we call the end of life. So when someone passing away or dying, with the same eyes, and look to see the transformation, the continuation. This can help us not to suffer so much with the experience of losing them. When someone passes away, we can no longer see them with our eyes. We can no longer hear them, hear their voice. We can no longer touch their body. And these are things that we had experienced, and now we no longer can experience. So we had something. Because we had it, we can lose it. It's not there anymore. We feel loss. Loss is painful. We feel separate, we feel alone. And the changes that it brings to so many dimensions of our lives, they're big, they're real. It could take a lot of time to get used to. When we look at our loved one, we are used to seeing the shape of their body, the shape of a human body. And some part of us believes that our loved one is that body. But let us look deeply. That body is made of earth and water and made of ancestors. The shape of the body of our loved one is actually the shape of the earth element, the flow of the water element, the transformation and continuation of our ancestors. These things have not gone from the world. They were always there before. They were there through the life of our loved one, and they are still coursing through our experiences now. We have not lost the earth. We have not lost that water. We have not lost the experiences and the meaning of the life of our ancestors. Still here. I have a friend who passed away some years ago from colon cancer, Annie. And Annie loved so much the natural world, and she loved so much children, and she loved to share the natural world with children. She was an environmental educator. And this is a doorway for me to be able to look with these eyes of interbeing through those eyes. When I look at the earth, when I stop on a walk through the forest or on a beach to watch the waves, she loved the ocean, right? I can feel the love of Annie alive in the sound of the waves or in the soft mossy path in the forest, right? I've practiced to do this, right? I have to practice to do this, but I can do it. Yeah. When I see children being cared for, I see Annie. When I see the adoration in the eyes of people looking at young children, right, I see Annie. So in a way, I'm seeing her transformation body in the world, right? That was the meaning that she had in my life when she was there, and that meaning is still here. This way of looking with eyes of interbeing really helps me not to feel a sense of loss. It's different without her around, for sure. But not gone. When we listen to the voice of our loved one, we are used to a particular sound, a particular expression, a particular way, wit, tone. And we no longer hear that, and we might long to hear it or be sad because it's not there. But if we look deeply into the sound of a voice, we'll find so many amazing things. All the accomplishments and failures, all the life experiences, the habit energies, and all the learning that our loved one underwent in the world that shaped the sound of that voice and the kind of things and laughter or cries that came from them. All of those experiences are still a part of the world. Our loved one can be found, their voice can be heard if we look deeply. Many of you have heard me talk about my grandma, my mom's mom, my maternal grandmother, who I was close with for much of my life, especially early on, and she transmitted to me so many things. A love of art and creativity was one of them. Doing pottery in her home studio, seeing all the beautiful art and artifacts she would bring home when she traveled around the world, and her house was like a museum. She also taught me like a love of something that I really haven't watered that seed much, but it's still there and I can enjoy it. Football. American football. She was from Pittsburgh, and when I was growing up, the Pittsburgh Steelers were like the thing. So that lives in me, right? Okay. Like, I can be happy watching a football game, and I haven't nourished that in my daily life for decades, but it's there. She continues in me. One of the ways that she continues in me, though, is when I'm looking at artwork. And my grandmother was really talented artist, but she was also very shrewd and opinionated. And I've been standing in front of a painting, looking at it, wanting to take it in. But her voice is very clearly saying, "This one just does not have it." So when I listen carefully, I can find her within me, her voice within me. I think you can hear your loved one's voice in you too. When we're being with our loved ones, we are used to a kind of unique energy, glow, feeling, presence. Their particular quality, their particular way. And we love that so much. We don't want to dishonor them. We want to treasure how special they are, were. But even on the deep levels of their soul life, the place in them which was so particular, unique, that unique wave on the surface of the ocean, unlike any other, even that is an expression of the depths of the sea and a coming together of all the conditions in the cosmos. And all those conditions are still here. Tai told the story of standing on the deck 6 years after his mama passed away and looking at the full moon in the sky, feeling the light of the moon on his cheek, and suddenly opening his heart to allow that light to be that very special love and caress of his mother. His heart broke open to the no beginning, no end nature of his mom, and he did not suffer anymore being an orphan. Being without her. At that ceremony last month in Morning Sun, Fern, my dear partner, love, wife, was sitting in front of me. She was the bell inviter while I gave a little talk on this sort of thing. And I was looking at her while I was talking about this. And I suddenly had this sort of blossoming of inspiration. I knew Fern when I was 16 years old. We went to the same high school. We started dating a year later. And then we spent many years in and out of relationship. And then into a monastery. Celibate life that was going to go on forever, but didn't. And we are now married and have a family, and things have moved and changed a lot. I've known her for so long. But when I was a senior, I'd already been dating her a little bit, and I wrote on my yearbook page a quote from a song by Journey. Loving a music man ain't always what it's supposed to be. But right down the line, it's been you and me. I get the joy of rediscovering you. It's talking about going on the road and coming home, right? But that sentence was already meaningful to me at that moment. I had already started to learn something about this. I didn't know it. For me, it was infatuation, and I wanted to stay in love and keep the relationship at that time. But that line, I get the joy of rediscovering you, popped up in my mind while I was looking at Fern last month, sitting in front of me, this Dharma talk. And I said, all my life in my relationship with this very special person to me, I have given a lot of time and a lot of energy. I have wanted to rediscover her. I don't want to put her in a box. I don't want to, you know, think I know who she is. I want to constantly renew and deepen and rediscover who this person is, what inspires them. And we've done that with our loved ones. We give time and energy to our relationships with them. Why would that stop when they die? And that's what I saw in that moment. I said, I want to continue to rediscover you. Even after your body is no longer there, in the way that I know it. I always have been doing that anyway. And 7 years ago, that body was 100% different cells. Anyway, right? It's always been this process of transformation and continuation through life. Why would I stop looking? Well, if the relationship is meaningful to me, if the person is meaningful to me, right? I want to continue to do that. So, that's just an example of how this practice and teaching like lights us up. For me, I'm really inspired to want to see with these eyes of interbeing, to see the transformation and continuation of things. Yeah. Teachers and good friends have passed away, and we can continue to allow them to be present. Many of you know Bill Woodall. Came up here a few times for retreats from Boise. Yeah, and passed away a little over a year ago. I've been at 2 retreats in Boise since then. The first one was hard. This last one, just 2 weeks ago, was actually really fun. And Bill was really there. In so many of the smiles, in so many of the different songs that he loved, and the Sangha would sing. And they'd start crying and then realize, wait, there's joy in this. And they'd find Bill singing with them in that way. It was very, because this is our practice, we talked about it a lot. And it was really nice. It's like there's a process of learning and adjusting to a new way of being, but there isn't a loss or an end, right? And that to me is so rich. So rich. Like the forest. Remember? Go out in the forest. There's all these rotting logs everywhere. And it's healthy. It's good. Thank you for being on retreat this weekend. I feel really good and I'm really happy to be here. I love Montana. Sometimes I don't know how I didn't end up out here, but I didn't. Yeah. Yeah. I got so many projects. Yeah. I hope that you all have been able to find some renewal and energy through your practice and through each other. And I have. And I hope that we can carry some of this really wonderful energy that's alive and coursing through us right now out into the world to places where folks are really hungry for it. Yeah. Thank you.